Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and we are here for another episode of The Sound of Economics, in which we will try to understand better the geopolitical role of money, aka currencies and capital flows. I'm pleased to host Paola Subacchi. Ciao Paola, come stai?
Ciao Giuseppe, sto bene tu?
Bene, bene, very good, very good. Paola is professor of international economics and chair of the advisory board of the Global Policy Institute at the Queen Mary University of London. And she recently published The Cost of Free Money, a book which has more than something to do with our topic today. And we are going to explore this shortly. But I'm also happy to welcome to our conversation our senior scholars, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Giuseppe. How are you?
Good, good. And Michael Lee.
Hi, Giuseppe.
Thanks to all of you. I'm really happy that we are having this conversation together. Alicia from Hong Kong and Michael from Italy and Paola from London. That's really nice. And to kick off the conversation, I would like to be a bit provocative. When it comes to the afflictions of the global economy, almost everyone is quick to point the finger of blame at the state of international trade. But Paola, what about unconstrained capital flows?
Well, Giuseppe, let me start from the title, The Cost of Free Money, and because it covers many aspects of the world economy and actually and also the relations between the world economy and, if you like, the politics or the geopolitics. And the cost of free money could refer to the over-expansive monetary policy. For example, the low cost of borrowing, which is now very topical on the back of the current health emergency and economic crisis. But it also refers to the historical low inflation. We are still living in the, it used to be called the Great Moderation, but, you know, low inflation, which has been going on since the late 1990s. And this is actually translating very low consumer prices. And, you know, as an example, when we had the Black Friday sales at the end of November, there were garments on sales for less than $1, less than £1. And this is really is very, very low. And that bears huge amount of issues around even the environmental sustainability of these low prices. But there is also another aspect, which is like the ability and the unconstrained movement of capital and international capital. And when we talk about international capital, inevitably we talk about the dollar that has glued the world economy together in the last 30 years. So it's the main ingredient, if you like, of the globalization and the post-globalization, if you like. So this really is free money. Money moves around in the world and has a positive as well as problematic aspect. And again, let me, in order to answer your question, let me tell you in a nutshell what is the book about. And is the book advocates a rules-based international monetary system and discusses the forms of international cooperation, and I stress international cooperation, that are necessary to sustain this system. So again, we need a system in order to continue to trade and together, but also we need the rules then sustain the system. And so to come to your question, Giuseppe, so what is the problem with the unsustainable, unconstrained capital? Again, in a nutshell, is the free movement of capital tends to destabilize a system in which there are deep underlying questions about the relative competitive position of individual countries. And if this sounds a bit too complicated, I mean, let me give you a few examples from history. So again, competitive position is how countries are able to trade with each other. When President Trump says China is using unfair tactics in order to push its goods on international markets is referring to exactly this kind of problem. I mean, it's referring in a bad and politically incorrect way, but the fundamental issue is how countries trade with each other and sit in the same global economy in a sort of competitive way without creating tensions and conflicts. So we came across this problem several times in history. Before the Second World War, we had a system which was kept in balance until everything collapsed. And again, the problems with international trade came to the fore. It was, if you like, the lightning pole of a more underlying, a more deep problem, which is, again, how countries trade with each other and economies interact with each other. So the fact that we have unconstrained capital create even more problems, because when this system, we saw this before the Second World War, we saw that after the Second World War with the Bretton Woods and when the collapse of Bretton Woods, and we see it now, is when we come into this sort of short circuit and the system doesn't adjust anymore, unconstrained capital destabilizes even more the system, and we end up in a series of crises, normally financial and banking crises, then roll over into all sorts of other unpleasant effects. So again, that was the case in 1931. It was the case in 1968 when speculative attacks on sterling destabilized the Bretton Woods system. And again in 1971 with the dollar, that led to the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. And then we saw several financial crises in the last 20 years.
Well, that's extremely worrying at the same time, as much as it's interesting. Of course, I would like to ask, because you mentioned the dollar, you mentioned the global scene, and I'm obviously looking at Alicia, which is sitting on the other side of the world in Hong Kong. What's her first comment to your initial remarks?
It is absolutely right that unlimited, unconstrained capital flows can potentially, if not create, at least accelerate the event of a crisis. And that is no doubt about it. It's also true, though, that if we don't have free or at least relatively free movement of capital, we end up with other problems, which we're not going to discuss now, but in particular, what I would call protectionism of currencies. Yeah, I mean, you could push the use of a currency versus another currency. And this brings us to, indeed, the topic of our conversation of how to use a currency politically. And actually, that is easier in a world with capital controls, because eventually it's not, I mean, the use of a currency as an international currency might not be only determined by an economic rationale. So I guess that's when, you know, we are starting to see, and in exactly given where I'm sitting, the use of the renminbi as an international currency with constrained capital controls. And that's kind of an experiment, which is not the first time in history it happens, but certainly a very, very big experiment given China's size today. So I think it's interesting to see that there is a linkage between what Paola was saying, i.e. constrained versus unconstrained capital movements, and the way in which we support the internationalization of currencies. And I think this is something we can discuss further, but it's a very important idea.
If I may just ask you a follow-up question on this, because I have the impression that all those issues at some point were just debated or in the interest of investors, traders, and were much more or less in the realm of political science or geopolitics. While what Paola has been hinting at, and you are also hinting at, is that in the current debate, the use of currencies is kind of more driven by politics than economics. And Alicia, you've been arguing something like that in a recent blog, which we published at Bruegel, which I will link in the show notes. And what exactly is going on over there, like especially when we should look at the role of the euro, not only at the role of dollar and the role of the RMB?
Sure. So in that blog, we developed the idea, actually we, because it's Federico Steinberg from Real Instituto Elcano, I myself, developing the idea that, and we're not actually pushing for the euro to become a more important international currency. We're only describing why the euro might be regaining, because the euro lost a lot of ground, actually, during the European sovereign crisis. whether Europe might be regaining some of that role, even in the midst of a pandemic, which is affecting Europe humongously. So it's kind of weird, yeah? I mean, and interestingly, the reasons might indeed be geopolitical. One is, of course, soul searching for our economic sovereignty, and the currency is, of course, one of the key ways in which you can achieve that. So we are talking up the euro. We are including the euro with it in that basket of instruments for us to become less dependent on either the US or China. Of course, for the currency, it's obviously the US. And we are thinking about the extraterritorial use of the dollar that is affecting our investment, is affecting our relations with the rest of the world, Iran being a very good example. But there are many. So that's one. But the other reason, which we mentioned in this blog, why, in a way, the Europe may be somehow being pushed up in its international role, has nothing to do with Europe. It's actually China. And the reason is that China needs a vehicle currency, reserve currency, which, of course, is not the renminbi yet because it's not ready, or at least not fully ready, to move away from the dollar. And there's no other currency in the world that can do that better than the euro. So we've seen quite a lot of demand from, you know, the China actually issued a huge euro bond just a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago. And that's impressive how they are actually thinking, you know, the euro is also an international currency. And it's not because of the eurozone growing fast or anything like that. It's because it turns out to be handy. So this is indeed another reason why currencies can become more of a geopolitical instrument beyond the area to which they serve as such.
But wait, you've been mentioning that this is not linked to the eurozone being particularly brilliant, especially during a pandemic. And I kind of look at Michael to zoom in from the global part to understand a little bit better what is going on here in Europe. I mean, how do you see, Michael, how all those debts and deficits caused by COVID are affecting European economic prospects and the euro as such as a currency, and how this can be interrelated or not with what we're discussing about here?
Yeah, it's very perplexing in a way, because Alicia has talked about the euro's international role, the recent Chinese launch of a large loan in euros, and the euro seems to have done quite well in recent months against the dollar and so on. But against the background of the latest of the EU's polycrises, it was clear how the euro was buffeted around during the crisis of 2010, the financial crisis, the euro crisis. But if we look at the situation in Europe today, we have huge accumulations of debt. You know, to become a member of the euro, you have to meet what were the Maastricht criteria, the criteria of the Stability and Growth Pact, of which approaching 60% debt is one. I mean, now, largely as a result of COVID and the additional government spending, the average debt level, public debt level in the EU is over 90%. Italy is approaching 170% of GDP debt. And I just wonder how long this situation can continue without the euro being affected. Also, how sustainable is this debt? And how interesting is it for governments, for example, to take advantage of some of the new instruments introduced by the EU to fight COVID, like the famous recovery fund, of which more than half was intended to be loans. But in fact, interest rates so low, it's not that attractive for governments to borrow from the EU compared with the international capital markets. Maybe there's a marginal benefit to that. So my underlying perplexity is the euro and its problem seems to have sunk below the horizon now with these other developments. But how sustainable is that? And will there be a moment when the hit to the economy, the possible hit to the economy by this debt mountain will begin to affect the euro?
Paola, what do you think? How sustainable is that?
Well, a debt is sustainable as long as there is an underlying way to pay it back, to pay the obligations and the capital, so interest and capital. So the answer, the quick answer to Michael's very good question is, it depends on how this money is used for. If it's used to address current expenditure, it might be problematic. If it's used to actually lift the productivity growth and the long-term growth of the European economies, then it becomes sustainable. And it depends on who is holding this debt. Again, back to Michael's question, I don't entirely believe that borrowing on markets, first of all, the main thing is borrowing need to be responsible. And there is a need for transparency and accountability in borrowing. We are all basically in advanced economy, we tend to be pretty good compared to some developing countries, but there is more need for more transparency, more accountability, and more clarity about why we borrow. So responsible borrowing and responsible lending, that should be the key sort of starting point. And then again, borrowing on markets, it depends because market can change and they can change their mind and might decide and the use of their money might not be sustainable. And they exactly, because money is free to move around, they might decide, as we've seen in many, many episodes, then they want to go somewhere else or simply because somewhere else the returns are better. So again, back to Alicia's point, which I found very interesting on why China issued euro-denominated bonds, mainly because there is no market yet for renminbi-denominated bonds, because the renminbi is technically an international currency because it's part of this SDR basket that the International Monetary Fund uses. But effectively, it's not liquid and is not convertible enough to be, you know, used around the world. So there is not demand for renminbi-denominated bonds. And so China tested the market and responded to the demand from international investors by issuing euro-denominated bond at a better, obviously, a return than the euro-denominated bond issued by European countries. So that is the market. But again, money comes and money goes. And this is the cost of free money, exactly the cost of free money. So we need to be all very aware that even an advanced economy like the Eurozone is subject to this kind of movement. So we need to be very careful when we borrow. Having said that, it's very important that now we have an expansionary fiscal policy, then respond to the emergency, the COVID emergency, but also look ahead and forward and try to stimulate the economy to change somehow the gear of the growth of the European economy. So it's not only the emergency and the short term, but we need to plan for the long term as well.
Well, thank you, Paola. I don't know, Michael, if you wanted to add anything to this response to your question.
I agree entirely that it's a question not so much the absolute level of the debt, but the capacity of governments to service the debt. And that depends very much on growth and whether revenues will be such that governments don't run into problems. Because if they do, and starting possibly with Italy, the question of rescheduling the debt might arise at some point. We're far from that today, but unless we get back to healthy growth, you can't exclude that we might be facing that problem tomorrow.
That's certainly true. On the other hand, Paola, you are hinting about, and Alicia as well, you're all hinting to the global scenario and global politics and what is going on. I mean, the choice of China to issue bonds in euro was also linked to the politics of the United States. And that's where, actually, just for our listeners, we wanted to record this episode a few weeks ago before the US elections. And we waited for the results to be clear for recording this because, to a certain extent, I think the big question mark over there is what the Biden administration, and specifically the appointed Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, will do. There are some voices from former advisors of various politicians in the US. I mean, like I heard about Mark Summerlin, who was senior economic advisor to President George W. Bush. And he said the most interesting part of the Yellen pick will be what she decides to say on the dollar. So we obviously don't have a crystal ball here at The Sound of Economics, but perhaps, I don't know who would like to attempt a sort of analysis of what we could expect of the things to come when it comes to the dollar. Is this, you know, the trend that you are just outlined up to now is going to continue, or are we going to see some changes over there?
I can give it a try from the angle, of course, not of the value of the dollar, which is, I think, what probably these comments were referring to, but rather the use of the dollar, and in particular, the extraterritorial use of the dollar, which is one of the reasons why the euro is holding ground. And what we've seen, and one could argue that this is still Trump trying to harm China, but frankly speaking, maybe not. Maybe it's kind of a way for the Biden administration to accumulate instruments, if not arms, to contain China. Yeah, because if somebody else does that for you before you even come to power, you have it right there. It's a basket of stuff you can negotiate with. And this, of course, includes many, many things we've seen. The huge, by now, sanctions, actually, the list we have so far, in, I think it's 79 or 89 huge SOEs that will need to face these sanctions. So the question is, will Janet Yellen go along? Because this is crucial for the dollar. I mean, the reason why I think the dollar is only recently, because, of course, again, since the European sovereign crisis, the dollar was the one and only game in town. But recently, we've seen some embryonic increase in the use of the renminbi. And this is partially because it can be used, sorry to say, outside of SWIFT. This is a reality through swap lines between central banks. With the China's international payment system, it's even easier. So that's part of the story. It's minor, but relevant. And the other one is what I mentioned about the euro. So will Janet Yellen go alone? Will the dollar continue to be used as a way to deter or to contain China? And that's very important for the future of the dollar. And also for our, call it this way, intermediary role until the renminbi comes to the forefront of international currencies. So it's a very important question for us, actually, if you think about it, because I agree with Michael and Paula that, of course, we are very indebted, and who knows whether we should actually accept the currency of such an indebted region. But the US is indebted too, and China as well. It'll probably reach very easily 300% of GDP next year. So, you know, of course, potential growth is higher, everything you, I mean, you name it. But I don't think the game is the level of the debt. It's more like, for the time being, can I use this currency without worrying about sanctions? Maybe the answer for the euro is not really, frankly, because we are still very constrained. But it is important to look at the dollar, not only in terms of the level that they want to achieve, but that they want to keep it weak as it is now, but also its extraterritoriality. And that's really the geopolitical part of this conversation we're having now.
Paola, what do you think?
The US administration changed, but the reality is still the same. And it's that the dollar is our currency and your problem. That was true in the 1960s, as that it was said by the then Treasury Secretary, John Connolly, to the great disappointment and outrage French government. It was true in the 70s, it's true. It was true in the 80s, it's true still now. The dollar is by far the international and the key international currency. So, of course, Alicia is right. China is doing some steps to internationalize its currency, but it's all marginal. And China is very clear. They have no ambition to get the renminbi to replace the dollar in the position of the dollar as the dominant currency. They want the renminbi to be the currency of Asia. So they see an international monetary system as a multi-currency system. That is the way forward, and it will take probably several years, not say decades. China is not in a hurry. But also it's true that the dollar remains a problem for China, and the major weakness for China, even in geopolitical terms, is the fact that it doesn't have an international currency or an international currency, fully fledged international currency. And that reflects in many areas, including how China lends abroad, because China is a lender rather than a borrower. and he has to use dollars. The fact that China cannot provide the international safety net as the United States does through the international financial institutions that are controlled by the United States. And the currency used is the dollar. So again, it's a very clear system. What I say in my book, so I do a bit of publicity for my book, you know, until we switch to a different multi-currency system, we hope to switch in a peaceful, gradual way, then the world is actually in a better position if the United States doesn't have a belligerent, populist, ignorant president at his helm. And so the new administration bodes well in this respect. The United States has always, they have always used the dollars in geopolitical terms through sanctions, through blockages, and so on, but never like during the Trump administration, this has been in all sorts of areas. But again, I expect that Biden and the Biden administration will be very multilateral prone and very careful in using the dollar to just as a weapon, to the weaponization of the dollar. But obviously, that remains the fact that there are, let's say, countries which are not in the geopolitical sphere of the United States that are concerned about the dollar. And they are looking at alternatives. Unfortunately for them, the alternatives at the moment remains pretty small. And then again, in the next 4 years, I don't think we will see a substantial change in this picture.
Thank you, Paola. That makes it quite clear. And we are getting very close to the end of this episode. And I would like to have a last round just of final thoughts among you, especially getting back to the reflection about Europe and the European Union. What do we make out of it? You know, like in this situation, if you would have to reflect on one recommendation for 2021 when it comes to the euro and within this frame, what would you wish for 2021?
I would wish to for a return to positive growth, which means that the governments will have much more flexibility for a proactive fiscal policy, which, as Alicia mentioned, is really necessary to emerge from the present crisis.
Alicia?
I would like Europe to get together. What about that? And try to think as a team, finalize this single market that we've been pushing since I was a kid. And what else? I mean, if I guess that's such a big wish already that I won't go on. If we could do that, I would be quite happy by the end of the year.
And Paola?
Well, I wish then Europe will continue with the good work done in 2020. 2020 started with a pandemic. When the pandemic started, Europe was a bit caught on the back foot, and we all said, oh, usual stuff, they can't get together. Actually, no, there were some very, very fundamental changes. And I hope that will continue. There was a fundamental shift in attitude towards a more solidarity, a more fiscal solidarity. And obviously, as the Germans said very clearly, the pandemic is not anybody's fault, and therefore we work together. So I think for sometimes Europe has been the most dynamic, I know it sounds quite strange, the most dynamic and the most and the best place to be in the world because of the response and the solidarity and the understanding that we need to actually maintain our social system and welfare system. And the pandemic made it very clear that countries with a profit-led, market-led healthcare system could not have the resilience to respond to a crisis like the one we are facing. And so our system, with all its faults, is still pretty good. And we need to cope. And I hope that 2021 will actually bring more awareness about how lucky we are to be in Europe compared to other parts of the world. And we should preserve this system and opening also to others and not being, again, fortress Europe, which I discovered was used by the United States in the late 1940s because they were concerned about Europe being too protective of its markets for, you know, against the US trade.
Thank you so much to all of you. I think with these positive wishes for 2021, we can close this episode, and I would like to thanks all our listeners for joining in to the Sound of Economics, and I would like to remind you that you can access all our analysis by the experts of Bruegel on our website on www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.